We're going to skip some chapters now. We're skipping photosynthesis, which is interesting. I really like photosynthesis, but you've learned it before, for one thing. And also, most people that take this class are more likely to pursue something human-oriented than plant. So we don't have time to get through everything. So that's why we're skipping ahead to chapter 24. And before I start this chapter, let's get straight some terms. We've been talking about glucose metabolism in various ways. There's four major terms, though, that are kind of confusing, so you have to think about what they mean. These terms are glycolysis, gluconeogenesis, glycogenolysis, and glycogenesis. They sound similar, but think about what they mean. Glycolysis is the splitting of glucose, right? Splitting of sugar. Gluconeogenesis is production of new glucose. These are the two that we've already talked about. What is glycogenolysis? The breakdown of glycogen, which is what this chapter is about. I think the name of the chapter is degradation of glycogen or glycogen degradation, but it really is, in one word, glycogenolysis. And then glycogenesis is production of glycogen. All right? So two of them have to do with a monosaccharide. Two of them have to do with a polysaccharide. Glycogen is not only a polysaccharide, but functionally it's what kind of polysaccharide? It's a storage polysaccharide, exactly. We're looking at a couple cartoon versions of glycogen in this first slide. And it's not only a storage polysaccharide, but it's a polysaccharide made up almost completely of glucose. The reason I say almost is because to start a glycogen molecule, you actually have to start with a protein, which is what this G thing is. This G stands for glycogenin, which not only is a protein, it's actually an enzyme that is necessary to get the building of this polysaccharide started, but it also stays as part of the glycogen molecule. And we'll talk more about that in the next chapter, because in this chapter, we're concerned with tearing this molecule down rather than building it up. But all the rest of it, every one of these little black circles, is a glucose residue. So glycogen is not only a polysaccharide, it's a polysaccharide made up of just one monosaccharide, just over and over. And starch is another version, right? Also using just glucose, but put together a little differently. The major difference structurally between starch, which predominates in plants, compared to glycogen, which is what we make predominantly, is that glycogen is much more branched. They both use nothing but glucose, but glycogen has many more branches in it for an individual glycogen molecule. So you can see that branching starting on the right here, and this is a glycogen molecule that hasn't gotten very big yet, but you already see the many branches. In fact, there's a branch just about every 10 or so glucose residues. So no strand gets very long before it branches again. And by the time you've added very, very many glucoses, you get this mess that's on the left side. Still with a glycogenin in the middle, but the rest of it is pure carbohydrate. All right, well, let's look at what has to happen in order to break this thing down. First of all, do you want to break down glycogen? Why would you, I mean? Right, when blood glucose levels get low, that's a serious situation. Because there's a couple tissues in your body that need glucose continuously. The brain uses glucose almost exclusively. Under normal situations, that's the only fuel it uses. only under starvation conditions is the brain also able to use ketone bodies, and it does pretty well on that as well, but that's an abnormal situation. On day-to-day, it uses nothing but glucose, and starvation or not, red blood cells use only glucose. That's the only fuel source they can use. So there has to be a continuous level of glucose being delivered to these tissues, but glucose, of course, is also an important fuel for all the other tissues. The other tissues have choices beyond glucose. They can use fatty acids as well, right? That's an important energy source because of the energy density of fatty acids. You know, it makes sense that our body stores fatty acids when we have extra energy coming in the form of more food than we need, because that allows us to more efficiently store that energy and not actually weigh as much as we would if we stored it all as carbohydrate or as protein. But we do, even though glycogen doesn't store the extra energy as efficiently as fats do, we still want to have a glycogen store on hand, even though it is stored less efficiently. And that's because because glucose, which comes from glycogen, once it's liberated from glycogen, is able to be processed anaerobically in the very short run in an emergency situation. Or I shouldn't say emergency, if it's demanded very quickly, the energy can be liberated from glucose very quickly. Fatty acids, which we haven't talked about their use as fuels yet, when they are used, the only way to do that is to deliver them to the citric acid cycle, which is part of cellular respiration. So that's an oxygen-requiring process. Okay. So that's the rationale, basically, behind having a certain amount of storage in the form of glycogen. But whereas there is effectively no limit to the amount of fats that you can store in your body, until you kill yourself with it, there is only so much glycogen that we store. And it's really roughly about as much energy as will last you a day. If you don't eat, your glycogen stores will get you through that day, and then they'll be depleted. And that's why if you continue not to eat after that day, then you're going to start burning that fat. But you're also going to have to start doing what process in order to keep your brain alive? If your glycogen stores have been depleted and you're no longer eating. What is it? Gluconeogenesis. Glycogenesis means creating the glycogen. You're not going to do that when you're not eating, right? You're doing the opposite of that when you're not eating. You're undergoing glycogenolysis so that you can dump this glucose that's coming from the glycogen into the blood to keep the level steady. But if you've done that with all of your glycogen and you've run out of glycogen in your body, you've run out of glucose in your body and you're not eating anymore, you're not going to want to build glycogen molecules because that takes glucose to do, and that would take it away from your brain, right? So when you're not bringing in any glucose but you still have to run your brain, you have to make glucose anew. You have to make it out of stuff that's not glucose to begin with. That's what gluconeogenesis is. Okay, so that's what will happen after that day, after your glycogen stores are depleted and you're still not eating. All right, anyway, let's think about the particulars of glycogenolysis. This highly branched glycogen molecule, if it's going to be used for fuel, needs to be dismantled one glucose residue at a time. So the tips of all these branches get picked of glucose, one residue at a time, in the process that we call glycogenolysis. And it's fairly simple, but still involves four enzymes to get the job done. The chief enzyme, and the one, as we'll see, that is the major control point for this process, is one that's called glycogen phosphorylase. And that's because it catalyzes a phosphorolysis reaction. That's what we're looking at here. We're dismantling a molecule. We're breaking it into smaller chunks. Now, up to now, whenever we've been doing that, it's been a hydrolysis reaction that's taken care of that, right? But it's not water coming in at the top. What is HPO4 2-? What is it? It's phosphate. Right? So a phosphate instead of a water is allowing this breaking apart of the glycogen. And that's why we don't call it hydrolysis. We call it phosphorolysis. And that's a neat trick because since it's phosphorolysis, that means a phosphoryl group is going to be stuck on to the glucose that gets liberated from the glycogen. And so you already have a phosphorylated glucose, an activated glucose, which is a useful thing to enter the glycolytic pathway, right? It's already activated, whereas it wouldn't be if it were just glucose. You could activate it, which you do with glucose that's coming in from the diet, right? You activate it by putting a phosphate on it originally. That's already happening here. So glucose 1-phosphate is what's being produced. Okay? Now on the left is the glycogen molecule. We're only seeing part of it. This is just the tip of one branch. The R here stands for all the rest of this huge glycogen molecule. This is just one tip. The left part is specifically the end. This is not the end. Okay? And the glycogen phosphorylase enzyme allows for this phosphate to come in, get stuck on to C1, the first carbon of this glucose residue. And that's why when it's on its own, now it's glucose 1-phosphate. That leaves the whole rest of the glycogen. And the hydrogen from the HPO4 2- gets stuck onto that to complete the valence for that oxygen. Okay, but now it's one residue fewer or smaller. It's N-1 residues now. Now, glucose 1-phosphate, like I said, is an activated glucose, but it's not quite the right version, right, for glycolysis. And this glycogenolysis, this can occur in basically any tissue. Just about any tissue is able to make some glycogen and therefore reverse the process and dismantle it for energy. But there are only a couple places in the body that really store an appreciable amount of glycogen. And where are those two places? Liver and skeletal muscle, exactly. Skeletal muscle, when it undergoes glycogenolysis, it's doing it selfishly. The glucose that it liberates by dismantling its own glycogen, it's going to keep in its cells and use for its own glycolysis to make ATP to power the contraction of those muscles. But glucose 1-phosphate is not the right phosphoglucose, right? Which one is the right one? Glucose 6-phosphate, right? And so another enzyme is going to be responsible for transforming this glucose 1-phosphate that gets spit out because of the action of glycogen phosphorylase. A second enzyme is going to then transform that glucose 1-phosphate into glucose 6-phosphate. And really what's happening is that you're transforming one phosphoglucose form into another phosphoglucose form. So first of all, they're isomers of each other, right? So that's an isomerization reaction. But in this case, to change one isomer into the other isomer, really all you're doing is taking a functional group, a phosphoryl, off of one part of that molecule and sticking it onto another part of that same molecule. And what specific kind of isomerization is that? I mean, what enzyme? A mutase would take care of that, which is why the enzyme that deals with this glucose 1-phosphate and transforms it into glucose 6-phosphate is phosphoglucomutase. All right? Once you have glucose 6-phosphate, that goes directly into the glycolytic pathway. Where do we normally get glucose 6-phosphate if we're talking about glucose that's coming in as food? What enzyme makes that for us? Hexokinase, right? It takes glucose that's not phosphorylated and phosphorylates it at the sixth carbon to make glucose 6-phosphate. This makes glucose 6-phosphate from a glucose residue that's liberated from glycogen. All right, so that's two enzymes. Now let's go to slide 3 and look at one branch point. So the R here on the right, that's the rest of the huge molecule. This is one linear chain of glucose residues. And those are all produced by alpha-1,4 glycosidic linkages, like we've talked about in other chapters. Okay? The carbon 1 and the carbon 4 are stuck together by a glycosidic linkage all the way down that line. But right here, there's a branch point. Remember that unlike nucleic acids and polypeptides, polysaccharides are polymers that can branch because there's multiple places on the same subunit where you can make a connection. Specifically, the sixth carbon, which is hanging off of the ring, is another place where you can have a glycosidic linkage, and that would make a alpha-1,6 glycosidic linkage. So that's the branch point off of this one chain. At the very tips of these, however long they are what are those are the residues that actually get picked off one at a time by glycogen phosphorylase. These are called the non-reducing ends. Just think back of when we talked about reducing sugars. A monosaccharide by itself can be either linear or ring form, right? And when it's in linear form, it's this carbon that is allows this thing to be a reducing sugar, like we've discussed. So the other side of the ring is simply called the non-reducing ends. That's the only part of this whole glycogen molecule that glycogen phosphorylase can operate on. It really just amounts to what I've already told you. It only picks them off at the very tips of any branch. Let's go on to slide 4 now and look at a schematic representation of the process and see what other enzymes are involved. So you have the core, the rest of the molecule on the right there, and then these two branches. Glycogen phosphorylase picks glucose residues off one at a time from the tips, but it can only do that until it gets to 4 residues away from a branch point, which is why the pink ones stop when you have 4 more residues before the branch. You see what I'm saying there? The branch point is right there. Well, the enzyme can work one at a time until it only gets to that close to the branch point and it can't work anymore. That's why you need other enzymes to continue the process. It may be a total waste of energy if you just left those in the glycogen and never used them for fuel. They're still valuable glucose residues. So phosphorylase does its job as far as it can. Then when you have 4 residues away from the branch point, you need another enzyme operating as a transferase to take 3 of the 4 glucose residues that have branched off of the chain, in other words, the blue ones, remove them from that and stick them onto the end of the linear chain, the yellow ones. That's what's happened right here. These blue ones are now on this linear chain rather than being on this branch. So those are now available for glycogen phosphorylase to pick off one at a time, right? Now that transferase has done its job. But you still have this branch point, so it would still only work up to this point, unless you get rid of this branch itself. That branch now consists of just one glucose residue hanging off of the linear chain. But because of that 1,6, that alpha 1,6 glycosidic linkage, it requires its own enzyme to deal with. And that separate enzyme is alpha 1,6 glucosidase. Or you can pronounce it glucosidase. Either one's fine. Now notice that is a hydrolysis reaction. Water's coming in. And therefore, since it's hydrolysis and not phosphorolysis, that green glucose that's liberated and therefore eliminates the branch entirely is just a free glucose, an unmodified glucose. It's not phosphorylated. Okay? Now, if this is skeletal muscle, that is a situation that needs to be dealt with because, like I said, the skeletal muscle wants to keep this glucose for itself. The problem is free glucose can diffuse back, it can move back out into the blood, right? Which is why, what is the first thing that you do with incoming glucose if you're a skeletal muscle? You phosphorylate it so that not only to activate it, but to lock it into the cell. So this free glucose needs to undergo the same modification that glucose coming in from the blood as food needs to do. What is the enzyme that phosphorylates it? Hexokinase. So hexokinase, the same exact hexokinase that operates in glycolysis, will phosphorylate this as part of glycolysis. The cell can't tell that this came from glycogen compared to one just coming in from the blood. It just deals with free glucose the same way it deals with any free glucose. On the other hand, if this is liver, the liver, when it... Which stores per gram of organ more glycogen than anywhere else in the body. Most of the glycogen stores are in your skeletal muscles simply because you have so much mass of skeletal muscles, especially me. But the liver stores that glycogen not for itself, it stores it to dump out for the rest of the body to use, not only the brain, but everything else as well. And so the free glucose that's produced by this same process in the liver won't undergo that phosphorylation. It'll just be delivered into the bloodstream to keep the brain alive. Okay, but anyway, we've now eliminated the branch, and therefore glycogen phosphorylase can continue picking down until it gets to another branch. And the same thing just happens over and over. All right? So those are the four enzymes. The glycogen phosphorylase to pick off one glucose residue at a time. What enzyme is working here to deal with the glucose 1-phosphate? Phosphoglucomutase, right? That will transform it into glucose 6-phosphate. Transferase is the one that gets rid of most of the branch and puts it on to the linear part. And then the alpha 1,6 glucosidase, which is also called the debranching enzyme, will actually eliminate the branch by taking that one remaining glucose that's hanging off of the chain. So it's just that over and over because you have branches everywhere in this glycogen molecule until you run out of glucoses. In slide 5, we're just looking at the action of alpha 1,6 glucosidase. So this on the left is the glycogen molecule, however big. Notice the R prime. This is the glucose residue that is part of the branch because this is the alpha 1,6 glycosidic linkage. By the way, this is called a glucosidase because a glucoside, which is part of the enzyme word, is a specific kind of glycoside. A glycoside with a Y is a chemical that contains a sugar hooked to something via a glycosidic linkage. Makes sense, right? Glycosidic linkage forms a glycoside. A glucoside is specifically a glycoside in which the sugar is glucose rather than some other sugar. So that's why this thing is called glucosidase. It breaks a glucoside apart and liberates the glucose. Okay, let's look at slide 6 now, which is a cartoon version of what enzyme. What is this enzyme that's working based on what you see happening here? Glucose 1-phosphate is being transformed into glucose 6-phosphate. So this is which enzyme? Phosphoglucomutase, exactly. The phosphoglucomutase actually operates because the enzyme's active site has a serine residue. Serine is one of the amino acids making up this overall enzyme. The serine residue, though, is phosphorylated to begin with before it undergoes its catalytic activity. Then glucose 1-phosphate, which gets spit off from the action of glycogen phosphorylase, comes into the active site. It already has 1-phosphate on it, right? The problem is it's in the wrong position. The blue phosphate, though, it already has because of the phosphorolysis reaction. It comes in and receives the glucose 1-phosphate, receives the phosphate that's being carried by the serine, and it receives it at the 6th position. So now, for the moment, you have a doubly phosphorylated glucose, which is why the intermediate is called glucose 1,6-bisphosphate. Then it's just a matter of resetting the enzyme by getting rid of the phosphate that it came in with, the blue one, sticking that one, which is in the wrong position, onto the serine to reset the enzyme, leaving it with just 1-phosphate in the correct position, position 6, glucose 6-phosphate. So that just happens over and over for all the vast majority of the glucose residues that are liberated from glycogenolysis are in the form of glucose 1-phosphate because most of them get picked off by glycogen phosphorylase. All right, that's the basics of how glycogenolysis operates. Now let's talk about the control of it. In 7, we're looking at two forms of the glycogen phosphorylase enzyme, which I said is the one that's really controlled in this process. There really are 4 forms, in a sense, 4 different conformations that it can take on, 4 different shapes. But we can distinguish between the A form and the B form first. The A form is much more active, has much higher catalytic activity than the B form does. So it's not that one is completely turned on and one is completely turned off. The A form is more turned on, though, than the B form, by far. Each form, though, A and B, exists in 2 different states, which is a different shape change compared to the A to B change. The 2 states are the R state and the T state. R for relaxed, a looser configuration, and T for tense, a tighter conformation. Okay? Whether the enzyme is in the A form or the B form, there is both a T state and an R state, and the T state is less active than the R state. Therefore, there's 4 overall possibilities, right? And you see the 4 possibilities in slide 8. 4 possibilities are the A form in the T state, the A form in the R state, the B form in the T state, and the B form in the R state. So what is the most highly active of all 4 of those? The A form in the R state. That's fully turned on, basically. And So the way this is drawn in slide 8 shows you that to transform the A form into the B form, and A, notice, is on the right here. Well, let me just do it from left to right. To transform the B into the A, meaning to make the less active form into the more active A form, requires a phosphorylation. So the phosphates, and it's two phosphates required, one for each of the two polypeptide subunits that make up this multimeric enzyme. Phosphorylating it, though, in this case, activates it. Activates it by transforming B into the A form. That's one kind of modification, though. There are other modifications that can transform either one of these two forms from the R state to the T state or vice versa. So that's the vertical change in the slide. And those are allosteric modifications. Instead of adding or taking away a phosphate, metabolites, intermediates in the process that this enzyme catalyzes, can stick on to the allosteric sites and transform it between R and T state. Okay, like we've seen for other enzymes. Well, in 9 we can see this. Here we have phosphorylase B, so this is the less active form, as you would typically find predominating in resting muscle. And so it's B, it is the B form because it's not phosphorylated at the moment. Okay? That's what makes it B. But it's also going to be able to go between T state and R state while it's still in the B form. So even though B is not as active as A, you can still have a more active B than a less active B simply by transforming it from T to R. And look at what's written in black and pink letters above and below the reversible arrows here. AMP molecules are what are able to allosterically bind to these nucleotide binding sites. And if AMP gets bound there, that's going to transform this thing into the R state, which means it's going to make it more active. Not as active as an A form, but more active than a fully shut down B form. Why does this make sense that AMP would do this? Right, AMP is a signal that energy charge is low, right? Why would energy charge be low? Well, all of a sudden you're using those muscles, so the available ATP gets used, forming ADP. But remember, some ADP gets used to phosphorylate other ADP to turn it back into ATP, and that leaves AMP behind. The more AMP builds up, the more it's a signal to the cell that I'm active now as a muscle. You need to ramp up production of ATP, right? How do you ramp up production of ATP in the short run? By burning a quick fuel, right? Glucose. Which means use the glycogen stores on hand that's already in that muscle. Degrade the glycogen into glucose to use for ATP production. In the very short run, remember, the phosphagens are going to handle that. They're going to transfer their phosphates onto the ADP to make it into ATP, but that doesn't last very long. You don't have an infinite supply of phosphagen, so you have to ramp up production of ATP by aerobic respiration, which requires fuel, and that's in the form of glucose. On the other hand, an abundance of ATP means that you should not bother spending your stored glucose in the form of glycogen. You should keep it as glycogen. And that's why that will transform the ATP will transform it into the R state. I mean, back into the T state. It's not so much because ATP binds to it. It's because when there's a bunch of ATP, that means There is that much ATP because there's not much AMP, and therefore there's not the AMP is not available to bind to these sites, and it naturally goes back into this R state. Okay. In the A form, which we're seeing here in liver, now there's A and B forms in both liver and skeletal muscle. But they're just showing you this, using liver as an example, because in the liver, instead of the phosphorylase enzyme being normally off, like it is in, or normally low level, like it is in muscles, because you don't use your skeletal muscles continuously, right? They're, in terms of number of hours spent, the skeletal muscles are usually resting. So it makes sense to have those muscle phosphorylase enzymes normally low level. In the liver, they're normally turned on, and then they can be turned down if glycogenolysis is not necessary. Okay? So in the case of the liver version, it's not so much the energy charge that matters. That also will work to go back and forth between R and T state, just like it does in muscle. But in the liver, you don't have much variation in energy charge, because the liver doesn't undergo extremes with respect to cellular respiration. The level of ATP and AMP don't change much in the liver. So it's not a very reliable signal. Instead, the more important signal in the liver is the availability of glucose, as you see here. So there are allosteric binding sites for glucose on this phosphorylase enzyme as well. And notice, first of all, that this is the A form, not because of glucose, but because of the phosphates that are already on this thing. So that already makes it more active than the B form. But to make it maximally active, you want it to be the A form with the phosphates in also the R state. Okay? And that's going to happen when you don't have glucose available. When there's no glucose stuck to this thing allosterically, it's in the R state. That makes perfect sense, right? A lack of glucose means you need glucose quickly. So you want your enzyme, whose job it is to pick glucose residues off of glycogen, to operate as fast as possible for glycogenolysis. And that's exactly what happens. But once you have enough glucose on hand, either incoming from food that you've eaten recently, or just because you've spilled enough from the glycogen, then this thing is going to turn back down to the slightly reduced activity of the T state because of the binding of that glucose. It can still, though, be dephosphorylated to turn it down even more, because that's going to turn it from the B form into the A form, which is more of a reduction in activity. Okay, well, speaking of that, slide 11 illustrates how this happens. The allosteric regulation via the AMP and the glucose that we just talked about, those are intermediates, right, in the pathways that these things are involved in. So that's more of a classic feedback. There's another way to regulate this thing, though, which is with other kinds of signals rather than intermediates. So you have hormones that are available, that can do the job, and calcium is also an important signal in cells in general, which hopefully you remember from 181. This whole big mess of subunits that we see here is a kinase enzyme, phosphorylase kinase. Okay? Phosphorylase kinase is not phosphorylase. Phosphorylase kinase is a kinase enzyme whose job it is to phosphorylate glycogen phosphorylase. Okay? And remember that the phosphorylation of glycogen phosphorylase transforms it into the much more active A form. So phosphorylase kinase's job as a kinase is to drastically increase the activity of glycogen phosphorylase by phosphorylating it. Okay, but this kinase itself has differences in its activity. It can be inactive when it's in this form on the left. Notice that there are four different kinds of subunits, and there's four copies of each of those four subunits for this complex enzyme. The four kinds of subunits, though, are alpha, beta, gamma, and delta. The gamma subunit, which is the one colored pink, is the catalytic subunit. That's where the active site is that allows for the phosphorylation of glycogen phosphorylase. All right? The delta site, delta subunit, the one right next to the gamma, is one that can receive calcium ions. In fact, this delta subunit is just calmodulin, which you might have remember learning about in Bio 1A1. Calmodulin is used for a lot of different purposes in cells, but it operates by having calcium bind to it, which causes a change, and depending on what cell it's in, it will cause some ultimate effect. Okay, so this delta can receive calcium ions. Well, that makes sense in skeletal muscle, especially, because skeletal muscle operates on the basis of the release of calcium ions from the sarcoplasmic reticulum in response to an action potential, the electrical signal that reaches a skeletal muscle. There is the release of calcium ions from the modified endoplasmic reticulum in a skeletal muscle cell, which is called the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And that calcium ions, those calcium ions that are spilled out, their binding to other things is what actually causes the contraction to occur. All right? But at the same time, these calcium ions, which will be there when the muscle is active, will bind to these delta sites on phosphorylase kinase to partially activate it. We can see the calciums here. So now the active sites are more amenable to receiving glycogen phosphorylase and phosphorylating it. But it's not as active as this phosphorylase kinase enzyme can be. That's just one way of turning it partially on. The other way of turning it partially on is through the action of protein kinase A, which is PKA. We've talked about it before. That's another versatile molecule. It does a lot of things, but it's a kinase, so it phosphorylates something. Well, the other way that this phosphorylase kinase enzyme, which is already a kinase, can be adjusted in its activity is to be phosphorylated itself. So there is a protein kinase enzyme operating as a kinase to phosphorylate phosphorylase kinase, turning it on so that it can more easily phosphorylate glycogen phosphorylase. All right? And if both of these things are... by the way, the hormones are chiefly glucagon and epinephrine. Okay? Now, glucagon is released when? When there is low blood glucose levels, when it's under fasting conditions, when it's been a while since you've eaten. Remember, it's kind of functionally the opposite of insulin. So that's exactly when you need to spill glucose out into the blood from the liver. But calcium ions operate as well separately, and if you have both signals, then you have a very active phosphorylase kinase enzyme, very able to phosphorylate glycogen phosphorylase, turning the B form into the A form. So these phosphates that get stuck on, those come from ATP. Those are separate from the phosphates that activate the phosphorylase kinase enzyme. Okay? And so I have to stop there, but that's not quite done with the complexity of that.